And they and we all agree Jesus came at the end of the 69th week, because it says so in verse 26, or verse 25. You know, there should be 7 weeks and 62 weeks until the Messiah comes. So the Messiah comes at the end of the 62 weeks, which is at the end of the 7 weeks. So you got after 69 weeks, the Messiah comes. So everyone agrees that the 69th week ended when Jesus was here. But what is not agreed upon is whether the 70th week began after that or not. Now, the dispensational view holds that the 70th week is still future and is to be identified with a 7-year tribulation. And, by the way, this identification is the whole argument for a 7-year tribulation. There is no reference to a 7-year tribulation in the Olivet Discourse. There is no reference to a 7-year tribulation in the Book of Revelation. There is no reference to a 7-year tribulation anywhere in the Bible. But the idea that there will be a 7-year tribulation is deduced from this verse. That came as a rude awakening for me once after teaching for many years. Even after I was all millennial, I still taught there was a 7-year tribulation. And then Danny Lehman asked me once, where do we get the, on what scripture do we base our view of a 7-year tribulation? By the way, he still believes in it, but he asked me that question, and it made me think for the first time, well, where do I get that from? And I said at the time, I said, well, I guess from the 70th week of Daniel, and from the fact that Revelation several times speaks of 3.5 years, and I guess if you put two of those together, you get 7 years. Although I realized at the time from having studied Revelation that there was no valid reason to put those together as two periods of 3.5 years, that every time 3.5 years is mentioned, it almost certainly is the same 3.5 years. So the whole idea of a 7-year tribulation, I realized, came from Daniel 9. I've since, that's been 15 years ago, I've had a chance to look for those verses since then quite a bit. They're not there. The whole idea that there is a 7-year tribulation is based on Daniel 9:27, and the assumption that the Antichrist is in view, making a covenant for a week. A week is obviously 7 years. But that week hasn't come yet, according to dispensationalism, so there's been a gap of 1900 and something years since the 69th week ended, but the 70th week has not yet begun. So you've got about a 2,000-year gap there, at least, maybe more. Depends on how long we have to wait yet before it starts. So this is one view, and in fact it's the popular view. It's the view upon which the whole doctrine of a 7-year tribulation is based. Now the question is this a doctrine built on sand, or is it built on a rock? Well, the assumption, of course, has got to be made that there's this big gap. Do you see a gap? Do you see such a gap in the passage? Remember, dispensationalists take everything literally. Which literal phrase, which literal word or verse in this passage tells us of a 2,000-year gap between the 69th week and the 70th week? We want to honor those who are committed to a literal interpretation. Read it carefully, comb through it. Where do we read of this gap? Now, if we did take this literally, what would we assume? Verse 24 says, 70 weeks are determined to fulfill all these six things. A period of 70 weeks. If my son said, how long will it be before I can get a driver's license? I said, well, let's see, you're 13 now. You can get one when you're 16 if you've got the money to buy a car and get your own insurance and so forth. That's 3 years. In 3 years, you can get your driver's license. Suppose 3 years from now comes and he says, can I get my driver's license? I say, not yet. Another year passes. He says, can I get it? Not yet. Eventually, 20 years pass. And he says, Dad, I thought you said that in 3 years I could get my driver's license. I said, well, that was true. The problem is I didn't tell you there's a 20-year interval between the second and third year. Now, he would probably feel like I would have been better off telling him nothing rather than deceiving him. To say it's going to be this long a time, 70 weeks, that's how long it is. And then to say, oh, but I didn't tell you there's a 2,000-year gap between the 69th and the 70th week. By the way, and he didn't tell, because it's not there. If it's there, it is the big secret that God didn't tell anyone. What he did tell is it would be this long, 490 years. That's what he did say. If it is in fact 2,490 years, then frankly, I think people might have grounds for thinking, God, maybe you didn't tell the truth. I mean, I hate to say it, because God always tells the truth. But I would say, in fact, because God always does the truth, tell the truth, I would say that those who think he didn't are the ones who are not telling the truth. And the ones who think he didn't are the ones who say that it was, in fact, more than 70 weeks. You cannot, with a time period, everything's going to happen within this time period, this long a time. You can't add more than five times or four times the length of that time to it without doing violence to the original information. Is that not correct? Does anyone disagree with that? You can disagree with me. You don't have to agree with me. That's okay. I mean, this is why, historically, before 1830, before they had to come up with a doctrine like this to fill the dispensational system, no Christian ever believed that the 70th week was separated by any great distance from the 69th week. Now, what has been pointed out here is that the 70 weeks is actually broken down into three pieces, isn't it, in the passage? 7 weeks, 62 weeks, and 1 week, right? Was there a gap between the 7 weeks and the beginning of the 62 weeks? No one I've ever heard of says there is. They consider that 7 weeks and 62 weeks is consecutive 69 weeks for 183 years. Yeah, right. But no one considers that and suggests a gap. You know, that's the thing. If we want to be consistent, then if we say, okay, every time we break it into pieces, 7 weeks, 6 weeks, and 1 week, we can put endless gaps between these different pieces. Well, why not put such a gap between the 7 weeks and the 62 weeks? No one has ever assumed that such would be valid. The dispensationalists certainly don't claim that. And yet they want a gap of four times as much as the whole 70 weeks, four times the length of the 490 years. They want to stick a gap hidden, unmentioned in Scripture, but hidden there between the 69th and 70th. Yes?
Do you have a gap in it?
It has a possible gap depending on interpretation of the second half of the 70th week, and I'm going to get to that. Okay? Yeah, we definitely are. We definitely are. In fact, we can get to that soon, right now, in fact. There are... The older way of understanding this passage was that Jesus is the one who confirmed the covenant with many for a week, 7 years. Now, what are these 7 years supposed to include? God's dealing with Israel, right? Because it has to do, it says in verse 24, these 70 weeks are determined for your people, that's the Jews, and your holy city, that's Jerusalem. Now, Jesus was cut off in the middle of the week. In the middle of the week, after 3.5 years, of ministry, he was crucified, brought an end to the sacrificial system. But the next question is, what about the other half of that week? What happened to the remainder of the 70th week? And here's where there are several options, some of which do involve a short gap, others don't. You don't need a gap there. See, the view I've generally held doesn't have a gap, but I'm open to a possibility of a short gap, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But I have held the view for many years, and I still do, that the 3.5 years after Jesus was crucified fulfilled the rest of the 70th week, that there were no gaps. And because of this, we have to find out what happened in the next 3.5 years after Jesus was crucified. Well, this is something we can't prove beyond the shadow of a doubt. But we do know that initially, after the gospel was, after the descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, the gospel was preached to the Jews only. For some period of time, some few years. We don't know exactly the number. The Acts doesn't give us enough details to know how many years. But we do know that sometime like, and most scholars think it was maybe within 3 or 4 years, after Jesus died and rose again, Saul of Tarsus was commissioned by Jesus to be an apostle of the Gentiles. That he was apprehended on the road to Damascus and told he was going to go to the Gentiles. Some people consider this marked the end of the 70th week, that God was no longer going to deal exclusively with the Jews. The 70 weeks pertain to Daniel's people, the Jews. And even after they crucified Christ, it was still to the Jews alone. For the most part, the Ethiopian eunuch might have been a proselyte and therefore still in the camp of the Jews. To the Jews alone, the gospel went. Some people would place it at the household of Cornelius event. Maybe that was the end of the 70th week. But the problem is that Luke doesn't give us the chronological information to know how much time had elapsed. So it is at least within the realm of possibility. We cannot prove this, and that's why this view might be critiqued. It can't be proved, but it can't be proved wrong either. It's possible that the conversion of Saul and his commission to go to the Gentiles, or the event at the household of Cornelius, where Peter went and the first Gentiles received the Holy Spirit and so forth, that one of those events could mark the end of the 70th week. That the gospel was no longer going to go exclusively to the Jews because the 70th week had run out, and 70 weeks was no longer going to be dealing with them. This requires no gap in any part of the 70 weeks. It just makes every year and every week follow immediately after the previous one, which is the most natural way to understand it, I think, and is probably the correct way. Now, I'll give you an alternative, and this does allow a gap, not anywhere near the kind of gap that the dispensational system has, but a gap nonetheless, and that is that some people think that the latter part of the 70th week, after Jesus was cut off after the first half of the week, 3.5 years of ministry, that the remaining 3.5 years, some think, refers to the Jewish war. It was, in fact, 3.5 years long, and the temple was destroyed at the end of that time. It is also the case that this prophecy predicts the fall of the temple and the destruction of the temple in the city. And therefore, some say this, that the destruction of Jerusalem falls within the 70 weeks consideration. But there is, in fact, a brief 33 or so year interval from the death of Jesus to the Jewish war, which began the end of the 70th week. And that by cutting off the Messiah, the Jews left themselves only 3.5 years of God's specific dealing. And that 3.5 years was the Jewish war and the destruction of Jerusalem. But that it was postponed for 33 years. Now, 33 years is not very long. It still extends the 70 weeks beyond an actual 70 weeks, and that could be a criticism against this view. But, let's put it this way. If we are going to insert gaps, if there was a gap implied, and I don't believe there was one in here, but if there was a gap implied, it does much less violence to the information to say, well, a gap of less than a generation, rather than a gap of 50 generations, or whatever, however many it's been in 2,000 years, it would not be misleading at all. And it could even be that just as when Jonah said, in 40 days Nineveh will perish, but they repented, and therefore, although Nineveh did perish a little later, it didn't do it within 40 days, that God gave, perhaps because of Jesus' prayer, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do, on the cross, or possibly because of the intercession of the apostles and the early Christians and the fact that there was a remnant saved out of Israel, or for whatever reason God wanted, that he may have given a brief postponement of the final destruction. So there are essentially three ways to interpret this. One is the dispensational way, where you've got a 2,000-year gap between the 6th, 9th, and 7th week. Another is this way I just mentioned, which shortens the gap to less than a generation, and where it'd be sort of like God giving a brief postponement of the destruction, and therefore the Messiah's cut off in the middle of the 70th week, then there's a postponement of the latter half of the week, and that latter half is fulfilled, as the prophecy suggests, in the destruction of Jerusalem, if some people see the destruction of Jerusalem as falling within the 70 weeks. And then the other view, which seems to have the fewest problems of all to me, is the view I suggested is my own view, that after Jesus died, for a period of a few years, we don't know whether it was exactly 3.5, but there's nothing to prevent it from being. We don't know. But we know something close to that, something like that, if not exactly that, was the length of time that the gospel went to the Jews only before it started going to the Gentiles. So that is least problematic. Now, the thing that makes maybe that view objectionable to some is they would say, but the destruction of Jerusalem is within the 70 weeks, they would say. That it is prophesied that the destruction of Jerusalem will fall within the 70 weeks. But I'm not sure it does say that. It says the Messiah will be cut off within the 70 weeks. And it also tells us there will be a destruction of Jerusalem, but it doesn't say that'll happen within the 70 weeks too. It's not necessary to assume that the destruction of Jerusalem must also fall within the 70 weeks because it's not explicitly stated. What is explicitly stated is the Messiah will be cut off in the 70 weeks. There is also a mention of the fact that at some time, whether in or outside that 70 weeks is not specified, at some point, Jerusalem will also be destroyed, subsequent to the Messiah's death. So, depending on whether you think it most likely that the prophecy is saying the destruction of Jerusalem falls within the 70 weeks, or that it's not saying that, it would be what would give you the choice. You see, if you feel that the destruction of Jerusalem is predicted to fall within the 70 weeks, then it would be most likely that the Jewish war, the 3.5 years of Jewish war culminating in the destruction of Jerusalem, is the second half of the 70th week, and you'd have to argue for some postponement of the second half. And that's similar in principle to what the dispensationalist does. But you can't compare lightning with lightning bugs. I mean, a gap of 30 years is not a gap of 2,000 years. You know, I mean, if some kind of information is here being communicated to Daniel, and it is chronological information. I mean, it would be one thing if the angel just came and said, listen, someday the Messiah is going to come. Someday the Messiah will be cut off, and someday Jerusalem will be destroyed, and no time frame is suggested. It's just, you know, general prophecy. Like most of the, you know, most prophets don't give any time frame. Most of the prophets just say this is going to happen, but they don't say when. This is a prophecy that specifically is there to tell us when. How long? And if in fact its fulfillment has not yet taken place, even now, 2,000 years longer than the period of time that was specified, then it seems like it would have been better not to say when, since it didn't really tell us when. What's the point of giving the impression? Why would God give the impression that he's telling his people when something's going to happen when he's not really telling them when it's going to happen? He's actually seemingly giving them a wrong impression. Well, anyway, I will say this. All things considered, I have myself obviously come to the conclusion that he, in verse 27, makes no reference to Antichrist. In fact, I don't believe Antichrist is mentioned, a future Antichrist mentioned anywhere in Daniel. Certainly not in this prophecy. Do you see an Antichrist anywhere else in this prophecy? The prince who is to come certainly in no way stands out as a reference to a future Antichrist. Now, by the way, dispensationalists sometimes, when I point this out, they say, but wait, this couldn't be Titus. The prince that should come should not be Titus because it says he's the prince who is to come. And Titus is in the past. But there's another prince who is to come in the future. Well, I hope you wouldn't even need to hear the rebuttal to that. Obviously, in Daniel's time, Titus was still future. Just because something was future from the standpoint of the prophet doesn't mean it remains future from our standpoint forever afterwards. Yes, Ted?
I was just going to ask you, what about the Jewish word, like you see
still trying to win them over?
Yeah.
Well, maybe. But you know, even if we don't interpret the Jewish war as God's attempt to win them back, but he just said, okay, it's time up for you, and this is how you're going down, it would still be that this appeared accomplished on Daniel's people. I mean, it still has to do with God's dealing with Israel. Maybe not his restorative dealing. Hard to say. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, there's that possibility. I have a view, as I made clear. But I believe that the other view may have some merit. You see, here's another thing. Arguing for a 40-year gap, approximately, in the 70 weeks, as I say, it's not the same thing as arguing for a 2,000-year gap. Furthermore, Jesus... true. But let's look at Matthew 24. Maybe this will argue for that 40-year gap.
If you're a kid wanting a driver's license, 40 years might as well be 2,000.
You're right there. Well, let me show you something here. And of course, you're familiar with the Olivet Discourse, and we'll look at it again this Friday night. But in Matthew 24, verse 1, Jesus went out and departed from the temple. His disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone should be left here on another." Now, he's predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. Was the idea that Jerusalem be destroyed a new idea to the Jews? No, Daniel predicted it in Daniel chapter 9. The people of the prince who shall come is going to come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. Jesus was predicting what Daniel said would happen in the 70, or in the prophecy of the 70 weeks. Okay? Now they said in verse 3, when will these things be? And so forth. We have a long question. We'll deal with that in more detail later. But, I mean, they were curious. He predicted the destruction of the temple, and they said, well, when? What's the sign that this is about to happen and that you're going to come and so forth? And he gives signs and so forth. And then he says, as you know, in verse 34, "Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things are fulfilled." Now consider this. Jesus uttered this just a few days before he died. In other words, he uttered it in the midst of the 70th week, because he died in the middle of the 70th week. He uttered this a few days before. So one could suggest this. I'm not necessarily suggesting this, but it works, possibly. That what Jesus is saying, okay, we're in the middle of the 70th week, and just like Daniel said, the temple is going to be destroyed. But this generation won't pass until it's fulfilled. In other words, giving a hint, some could argue, that although one would expect the last 3.5 years in the destruction of Jerusalem to come immediately, he might be saying it's not going to be immediately, but it's going to be within this generation, which would be grounds for him for arguing that it got postponed by Jesus' own decree. You know, the angel gave a certain number of years, and Jesus basically unilaterally added a generation to it. You know, Jesus just said, okay, now we're at the point now where the second half of the 70th week should begin, but I'm gonna say that's just going to happen sometime within the next generation, within this generation. That would allow, and Jesus would have the authority to modify or to clarify what Gabriel had said. And it might prove a disappointment to the apostles who thought it would immediately come, that it will happen before they're dead, but not right away. That could be a disappointment, but Jesus would be entitled to add that. And we might even argue, if we wish, that this is the way we understand that the destruction of Jerusalem, which was to happen at the end of the 70th week, as some would say, Jesus postponed it from the point where it would be expected to come immediately to within that generation. And sure enough, it did happen with that generation. The 70th week came within 33 years of that time. That is, 36 years of that time. I've been saying 33 all this time. That's not been right. Within 36 years of that time. But the point here is, there's more than one way to look at it. And while it may not always be clear which is the right way, many times when you compare the views, there's one way that seems more wrong than others and more artificial than others. And to my mind, the transfer of the subject from the Messiah to some future Antichrist who's not even been mentioned previously is very unnatural and very unlikely to be correct. Although I once assumed it to be correct, it didn't take much looking at it carefully to realize that I had been basically told to see it there. And I couldn't find any reason to see it there if I hadn't been told to see it there. Now, my suggestion is that verses 26 and verses 27 are parallel in subject matter. They both start by telling of the death of the Messiah, and they both end by telling about the destruction of Jerusalem. They say it different ways. Verse 26 tells about the Messiah being cut off, and then tells about the people coming and destroying the city and the sanctuary. Verse 27 tells about the Messiah bringing an end to the sacrificial system in the midst of the 70th week, and ends, again, by telling about the destruction of the city and the sanctuary. And that's what the last lines is about. On the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. Jesus said to the disciples in Matthew 24, which we were looking at a moment ago, in Daniel chapter 24, verse 15, Jesus said, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee from the mountains. Now, he said his disciples would live to see it. They would see it, and they should flee when they do. And, of course, we saw in verse 34, he said, this generation won't pass before all these things are fulfilled. So Jesus is clearly referring to the 70th week of Daniel. When he talks about the abomination of desolation, that's where it comes from, is Daniel 9:27. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, which is also in Daniel 9:26. And he equates the two, basically. The abomination of desolation is that which precipitates the destruction of the city. So, in my understanding of Daniel 9, 26 and 27 are parallel to each other. They both begin with the death of the Messiah and its consequences, and they both end with the prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem. If this is true, and it certainly seems to me like it is, then there's nothing left of the 70 weeks to be fulfilled today. There is no future for the 70 weeks of Daniel. It's a wonderful prophecy. See, some people say, well, Steve, if you believe the Olivet Discourse is all fulfilled and Revelation's fulfilled and the 70 weeks of Daniel is all fulfilled, what's the use of having them in our Bible? Well, let me ask you this. What's the use of having Isaiah predicting that Cyrus would conquer Babylon and let the people go back to Jerusalem? Is there any value in having that in my Bible? Any value in reading that? For me, there is, although it's fulfilled. The vast majority of prophecies in the Bible are fulfilled. There's no question about that. The destruction of the Philistines, the Moabites, the Ammonites, that happened before Christ ever came to earth. And yet, that's the majority of prophecies in the Old Testament are about things that were fulfilled in the destruction of Israel or Judah or one of these other nations. Why would it be less valuable to us to know about the 70 weeks of Daniel if they happened to all be fulfilled? They prove that God unerringly predicted what he would do and when. It's certain that he predicted the timing of the Messiah. And that's an amazing thing, because really, the Jews are still looking for Messiah. And I don't know how they work with Daniel 9, because maybe they believe in 2,000-year gap also, but the rabbis didn't mention it, and neither did Daniel. But the point here is, whether this prophecy has been fulfilled or not, and I'm convinced that it has all been fulfilled now, it's still a valuable prophecy to read about. I mean, how wonderful to see. I mean, what's the value of seeing that Micah 5:2 predicted that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem? It's wonderful. It proves Jesus is the Messiah. Well, what's the value of seeing that Daniel predicted the Messiah would come in a certain year? Yeah, that also proves Jesus is the Messiah. And many other things do. Fulfilled prophecy is better than unfulfilled prophecy in terms of edification, because we never know when or how unfulfilled prophecy will be fulfilled. But fulfilled prophecy, we can look back and say, look, God predicted it here and he did it here. Tremendous. Okay, now, let's talk about the beginning and end of this period. And we're really, we may not get to chapter 10 as I thought. When did the period begin and when did it end? Okay, well, let's talk about the beginning first. It says in verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince shall be 69 weeks." Okay, so from one point to another point is 69 weeks, or 483 years. What's the beginning point? What's the ending point? Well, the ending point is the Messiah. But it doesn't specify what event in the Messiah's life is referred to. Is it his birth? His arrival here on earth? Is it the beginning of his ministry? The end of his ministry? His enthronement? What is, you know, it's vague. You know, okay, the Messiah, fine, but what event in his life is pictured here? Not all views that we'll consider have an agreement about that, but all agree that Jesus is the Messiah, and he fulfilled this. Well, let's talk about the beginning. One of the things that makes it hard is that there was more than one imperial decree made by different kings that have been thought to be the beginning point of this 69 weeks. The first is that made by Cyrus. I think I gave you this in our last session. I'll give it to you again, and we'll talk about the pros and cons of each one. Cyrus, in 539 BC, made a decree recorded in Ezra, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, that the Jews who had been taken captive into Babylon could now go back, with his endorsement and support, to rebuild the city and the temple. This decree of Cyrus was the first of any such decree, and would naturally be the one that most people would figure is the one that Daniel's referring to, or that Gabriel's referring to, the decree to restore and build Jerusalem. It was made by Cyrus in 539 BC. The only problem with that is if you measure forward 69 weeks from that date, or 483 years from that date, it appears to fall short by about 80 years of the ministry of Jesus. 70 or 80 years short. Now, about 70 or so years short. So that date is not in favor. Now, I'm going to come back to that and tell you that that might be the right date after all, but let me give you the other theories. There was a second decree of this sort made by Artaxerxes. Artaxerxes, in either 458 or 457 B.C., 458 or 457 B.C., allowed Ezra to take some of the captives who were still in Babylon back to Jerusalem to restore some of the religious norms there that had fallen into neglect. And the dispensationalist believes that this is the decree from which we begin to measure the weeks of Daniel. It is 458 or 457. There have been elaborate calculations done by a man named Sir Robert Anderson in England, a dispensationalist, and he endeavored to show that from this decree by Artaxerxes to the actual day that Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey on Palm Sunday was exactly 483 years to the day. Now, that would mean that Jesus rode into Jerusalem just before his death at the end of the 69th week. Now, he figured this out by using lunar years, the type that Jews usually use, 360-day years. If you do the simple math, it doesn't look like it works out, but it does if you transfigure the year from a 365-day year, which our dates calculated by, to 360. years, and it apparently it works out. Now, there are problems really determining the exact date of Artaxerxes' decree, just as there are problems determining the exact date of Jesus' triumphal entry, since no one knows for sure what year Jesus made that triumphal entry. But Sir Robert Anderson, nonetheless, has been followed by all dispensationalists, pretty much, as having the right computations here, so that this decree by Artaxerxes in 458 or 457 B.C. is the beginning of the 70 weeks. Now, on this assumption, the 69 weeks ran out at the end of Jesus' ministry, when he rode into Jerusalem on a donkey just a week before his resurrection. And they say that at that time, because the Jews did not receive him as their king, the prophetic clock stopped ticking. And the 70 weeks were interrupted. And the 69 weeks were now completed, but the clock stopped ticking, and it hasn't started ticking again since. And it will start ticking at the rapture of the church. When the church is raptured, then the 70th week will begin. And the clock that has been stalled for almost 2,000 years will start again. Yes, Darrell?
So you're saying that the gap begins with the times of the Gentiles. So when the times of the Gentiles comes in, that the Jews are ended. God's dealing with the Jews has ended. Thus, there's a gap. And as soon as the church is raptured and all the Gentiles have came in, then God will deal with the Jews in the 70th week.
Okay, what they're saying is that there is a gap between the 69th and 70th week. The gap began at the triumphal entry because the 69th week ended on that day, they say. That gap, which started at the Palm Sunday, is still a gap. It's still happening even now, almost 2,000 years later, and it will end at the rapture of the church. So that the gap is the period of, they say it's a parenthesis, that the church, where God is going after the Gentiles, is a parenthesis in God's dealings with Israel. And so there's this gap here. Although Paul says that the church and bringing in the Gentiles was not a parenthesis in God's dealings, but was God's eternal purpose. There is a very different view of the church held by dispensationalists. They don't believe that the church is anywhere near as significant as amillennialists do. I mean, the dispensational view is that it's Israel that's significant. The church is sort of a
time clock.
Yeah.
In God.
Well, maybe not, except that, maybe the church is as significant, but it's kind of an afterthought. You know, I mean, God wouldn't do it if he didn't have a break here. Yeah.
But the Jews were not bearing any fruit.
So we went to the Gentiles. Right, but after the church is over, at the rapture of the church, then the 70th week will begin. So that's the view of where it begins and ends on dispensational grounds. A third view begins it at, let me see here. The second decree of Artaxerxes, which is in 444 or 445 B.C., I just gave you the wrong information. This is the one the dispensationalists favor, but they do it in exactly the same way I said. Sir Robert Anderson took this date. I thought they did it from the first one, but I've fixed my brain here. 444 or 445 B.C., I gave you the wrong decree. It is the other one is a decree, but it's not the one the dispensationalists favor. This is the one they favor, and it is this one that they measure forward 483 years to the triumphal entry of Christ. So everything I said is the same, except I just gave the wrong decree as a starting point. There's three decrees all together, Cyrus, and then two by Artaxerxes. And it's the later one of Artaxerxes that's favored by the dispensationalists. Now, there are scholars who favor the middle one, that is the first decree of Artaxerxes. They are not the dispensationalists, but they believe that if you measure forward 490 years, that's the whole 70 weeks from this decree in 458 or 457, you come to the year 33 AD. Now, this is not changing solar years into lunar years, as many people think you should, and maybe you should, but this is just another way of reckoning. If you just count the number of regular years from the first decree of Artaxerxes forward 490 years, which is the whole 70 weeks, not 69, but all 70, you end up at the year 33 AD, which is about 3 years after Jesus was crucified. So, yeah. Okay, I'll give you all the dates again. The first decree, the one by Cyrus, was 539 BC. The second decree was the first of Artaxerxes. He made two. That's in 458 or 457 B.C. And then you've got the second decree of Artaxerxes, and that's the one that Nehemiah was allowed to go back to Jerusalem with his decree. That was 444 or 445 B.C. Okay, let me get back to the Cyrus decree. For many years, I didn't think there would be anyone who could really favor the Cyrus decree, although E.J. Young, a Protestant scholar in the early part of this century, in his commentary, felt like the decree of Cyrus was the right one, and he seemed to have more scripture on his side. It just didn't seem to work out chronologically. I mean, after all, Isaiah 44, verse 28, specifically names Cyrus as the one who would make the decree, saying to Jerusalem, "You shall be rebuilt." In Isaiah 44, 28, it says that Cyrus is my servant. He will perform all my will, even saying to Jerusalem, "You shall be built." That sounds like a decree to rebuild and restore Jerusalem. So Isaiah seems to identify the decree as that of Cyrus. Likewise, there's a great deal made in Ezra, the opening verses of Ezra, about how the decree of Cyrus fulfilled prophecy. Let's see here. After 2 Chronicles.
Ezra 1:1-4.
Yeah, Ezra 1:1-4. I'll just read that. "Now in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia," and then it gives his decree. He said in verse 2, "Thus says the king Cyrus, who to all the kingdoms of the earth, the Lord God of heaven has given me." We don't read all this, it's quite long, but basically he says in verse 4, "And whoever remains in any place where he sojourns, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold and go back," verse 3 says, "to build the house of his God," and so forth. The point here is, Cyrus made a decree that the Jerusalem and the temple should be rebuilt. And a great ado is made of it in Scripture. And therefore, scripturally, there's much to favor the decree of Cyrus, and the only thing against it is that the numbers don't seem to work out. And because the numbers didn't work out for many years, I didn't think it could be the right one, but I recently got this little book, The Wonders of Bible Chronology by Philip Morrow. And I learned some things that I didn't know before. Let me just read a few paragraphs for you, if I could. Basically, what he says is this, that the dates we have for the length of the Persian Empire are wrong. He says that when we say that the decree of Cyrus was made 439 B.C., that presupposes that this a chronology of history... What did I say? Yeah, it's 539, I'm sorry, yes. When we say that the decree of Cyrus is 539 B.C., that is based on a chronology that that assumes the Persian Empire lasted 205 years. However, he argues, there's no sound basis for that. There's very little historical documentation for the period, and he says that our dating of those years is based on the work of Ptolemy, a pagan astronomer in the 3rd century A.D., in other words, many hundreds of years after the event, like 600 years after the event, or 700 or 800 years after the event, Ptolemy doesn't even cite any ancient authorities for it. He lists 10 kings of Persia and makes the Persian Empire period 205 years. However, what Morrow points out is there are other sources more ancient than Ptolemy that disagree with Ptolemy. Josephus, for example, was 100 years earlier than Ptolemy, and he names only six kings total of the Persian Empire. I think he gives the references here. I don't have it right in front of me, but we can find them. But that Josephus says the total number of Persian kings was six. Ptolemy says 10, but Ptolemy lived 100 years after Josephus and doesn't have any documentation for what he said. Also, there's ancient Persian and Jewish traditions that place the whole length of the Persian Empire at 52 years, not 205. Now, Philip Morrow suggests that the Jewish tradition, the Persian tradition, aren't necessarily to be trusted any more than Ptolemy is, but that there just isn't any agreement among the different traditions in the pagan world about the length of the Persian Empire. But he said if we can choose whether we want to trust the Bible or trust pagan guesses, pagan guesswork that disagrees with one another. And he's arguing that the length of the Persian Empire was 80 years less than the 205 mentioned by Ptolemy. Now, he doesn't document that. He can't. He admits he can't. But what he points out is we can't really document anything else either. He's basing that on the Bible itself. He says the prophecy said it'd be 483 years from the decree to the coming, and that's what it was. He just assumes the Bible is right. What an outlandish thing to do. But let me just read a few paragraphs from him so you'll see how he argues it. I'd never heard this before about a few weeks ago. I'll just read a few paragraphs. He says, Ptolemy has left a record, on record, a canon or list of Persian kings from Cyrus to Alexander the Great of Macedon. Upon this canon, all modern chronologists have built their systems. And this for the simple reason that there is nothing else apart from the Bible for them to build on. But Ptolemy is not a contemporary historian, for he lived about 700 years after the reign of Cyrus. Nor does he refer to any contemporary historical records as authority for his statements. All we have is a bare list of names of supposed Persian kings with the number of their years each was supposed to have lived. Not only does Ptolemy lack corroboration in respect to his chronological statements, but he is contradicted by the writings of Josephus, the Jewish historian who lived a century earlier than Ptolemy. But most important of all, the canon of Ptolemy is in conflict with the chronology of the Old Testament, in the light of which it appears that Ptolemy makes the duration of the Persian Empire more than 80 years too long. This is positive and decisive proof of the erroneous and hence untrustworthy character of the canon of Ptolemy. Then he says down further, Ptolemy had no means of determining the chronology of the period, so he made the best use of materials he had and contrived to make a chronology. It is contradicted, one, by the national traditions of Persia, two, by the national traditions of the Jews, three, by the testimony of Josephus, and four, by the conflicting evidence of well-authenticated events, which makes the accepted chronology impossible. We have to choose between the heathen astronomer Ptolemy and the Hebrew prophet Daniel to base it on. Well, of course, he's assuming right from the beginning that Cyrus and his decree is the one we're to measure from. But biblically, it seems most natural that it would be. You can't prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt, but it seems that the Bible points to Cyrus and his decree as the one. I wanted to read one other paragraph from somebody quoted by Morrow, if I can find it here. Maybe I can't. But let's see here. Maybe I can't find it here. Okay, this is a quote from someone named Anstey. I must confess I don't know who Anstey was, but this is a quote from him. It says, there are no contemporary chronological records whatever to fix the dates of any of the Persian monarchs after Darius Hystapes. The clay tablets of Babylon fix the chronology for the reigns of Cyrus, Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdis, and Darius Hystapes, but they do not determine the date of any subsequent Persian king. The dates which have reached us, and which are now generally received as historical, are a late compilation made in the 2nd century AD and found in Ptolemy's canon. They rest upon the calculations or guesses made by Eratosthenes and certain vague floating traditions in accordance with which the period of the Persian Empire was mapped out to be 205 years. Well, this is new to me, so I must confess I can't speak with any authority on this. But I find it interesting that I didn't realize that the dates by which we say, well, Cyrus' decree was 539 B.C., that assumption, that date is fixed on Ptolemy's canon of lists of the Persian kings, which is shaky, to say the least. It's interesting that in Daniel chapter 11, Daniel is told by an angel there will be four more kings of Persia. It says in Daniel 11, verses 1 and 2,
I realize we're about out of time here,
that there will be three more kings, and then a fourth will rise of Persia. Well, there were actually, in Ptolemy's list, about seven more kings of Persia. But if the Bible is true, there were three or four. And therefore, it may be that Cyrus's decree is the one, and simply that the secular chronologies have gotten mixed up and messed up, and that the Bible has to be trusted to give us the right number of years. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. I didn't get to chapter 10, my mistake.